From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, when veterans are deported, what would happen if student loans were suddenly all forgiven, and the history of Pearl Beer. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Defense Secretary James Mattis said Thursday that undocumented immigrants brought into the United States as children who are serving in the military or received an honorable discharge will not face deportation despite the ongoing immigration debate in Washington. While negotiations over DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, has raised concerns among hundreds of thousands of young undocumented immigrants who would lose protection from deportation if the program is not continued, Mathis told reporters that recipients who were in the U.S. military are not at risk. However, a report released on Thursday by the Texas Civil Rights Project tells a different story. It documents cases of U.S. veterans without citizenship who have been deported or face deportation. The report is called Land of the Free, No Home to the Brave. The author is Emma Hilbert.
It's a big problem, especially down in the valley where our South Texas office is. People are recruited, and you know, with that, oftentimes they're promised as well that they'll gain their U.S. citizenship. For example, if they're a legal permanent resident, or otherwise a non-citizen, and you know, they serve honorably. They come out, and then oftentimes, you know, like many of their citizen comrades, they might commit a crime, oftentimes like a very minor, nonviolent crime, and then they see themselves facing deportation proceedings.
People do sign up to join the military. They serve honorably, but they may, maybe due to PTSD or some other circumstances, they break the law, and they get arrested. And then they go through proceedings where they have been deported.
Right, exactly. There are actually close to 900 DACA recipients who have, not veterans yet, but who are actively serving on active duty. So that's, you know, and that's only a tiny fraction of, you know, kind of the broader picture of legal permanent residents and other non-citizens who are also serving.
So we have this understanding of the problem. This happens to people. What kind of legal remedies are there? I mean, is that just on like, well, that's just too bad. You broke the law. You knew the rules, and now you're out, and now you're deported.
It sounds simple, but sometimes that's the problem, right? So currently, if you have to show up for a removal proceeding, the judge might or may not know you're even a veteran. But regardless, they don't actually have discretion. If you commit certain kinds of crimes, the judge actually doesn't even have discretion to even say, you know, look, you might have done this, you might have committed this crime, but you're overall, you know, a very upstanding member of the Texas community, and you served honorably. They can't even take that into consideration for many of these crimes. So that's a real problem. And it's a way, you know, people can't even say. Can't show that they were really, a huge part of the Texas community and the U.S. community as a whole.
What about their military benefits, especially if they're VA eligible?
So that's a good question. So one of the bigger problems we see is that, technically, even if you're deported, if you're living abroad, you can still receive VA health care, for example. The problem, though, is that in order to actually go to get that health care, you have to go to a VA hospital or a VA clinic. And once you're deported and not allowed to, you know, reenter the U.S. legally, then you're effectively blocked from receiving that health care that you earned. So that's definitely a problem for people who have not only physical injuries, but also, continuing mental health challenges like PTSD.
I've heard a lot of stories about confusion when people joining the military thinking that it's going to earn them citizenship, and once they're in, they realize it's not that simple. And particularly, it varies from branch of the service that there could be different rules.
It can be very confusing if you're trying to kind of wade through that bureaucracy on the front end. There is a provision in the law under immigration law that allows someone who, for example, is a, you know, legal permanent resident to apply for and actually expedite their citizenship process. And during times of war or hostility, which we're currently in since September, since 9/11, you actually only have to serve one day on active duty in order to have that kick in for you. So in theory, it's very easy. But in, like you mentioned, it can be difficult, or you can see problems arise when people don't always receive the information about that. So for example, if you look at the recruitment manuals for say the Army, Navy, and Air Force, only the Navy makes any mention of that provision. So they say, you know, recruiters should mention that, that recruits can have their citizenship. But a lot of times people don't even know that. Or conversely, they assume that, you know, once they enter the military, that it's automatic, that this is their naturalization is automatic, which is not true either. So you're right, it can be, what should be a straightforward process is actually, you know, kind of subject to these pitfalls.
Well, as we're talking about immigration reform in the United States, is there any discussion about what this means for veterans?
Right, you know, and they should be. You know, I think that is a critical part to discussion. You know, these are people who, you know, have proven their loyalty and their dedication and their hard work to stay in the U.S. And I know there have been, more than once there have been, you know, there's been legislation raised, not necessarily passed, but raised, that tries to address this issue. Recently, I know that one of Representative Vicente Gonzalez from Texas had a bill that would address some of this. And so, you know, that like, so fortunately, people are trying to get it through. But I think you're right. We're at a critical point where we kind of need to push the issue while we're considering immigration reform as a whole.
Emma Hilbert is a staff attorney with the Texas Civil Rights Project and is the author of the report, The Land of the Free, No Home to the Brave, a report on the social, economic, and moral cost of deporting veterans. Republican lawmakers in Washington, D.C. are pushing a higher education bill that would make earning a college degree more expensive for lower-income students. The House bill is called the PROSPER Act, which stands for Promoting Real Opportunity, Success, and Prosperity Through Education Reform. And if it becomes law, it would scrap federal supports that many university students depend on. According to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, college students would lose $15 billion in federal student aid over the next decade. Also, low-income students would no longer be able to avoid paying the interest on their student loans while in school and limiting their repayment options once they graduate. The legislation would also eliminate the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. Roughly 1 million student loan borrowers went into default last year, which some say is a red flag that the student loan system is in trouble and is in need of reform, but not the reform that Republican lawmakers are recommending. A report out of the Levy Economics Institute at Bard College projects what would happen if there was a zeroing out of all student loans in the nation and how that would impact the overall U.S. economy. Stephanie Kilton is a professor of economics and public policy at Stony Brook University and one of the authors of the report called The Macroeconomic Effects of Student Debt Cancellation.
The total amount of outstanding student loan debt today is somewhere around $1.4
trillion. This is loan debt for about 44 million Americans, and they've taken some college and some have graduated from college, but they all have to pay back what they borrowed to go to college.
That's right.
If so, the United States government has the ability to say, don't worry about it, we got it covered, and they would pick up the tab, and the U.S. government would be responsible for the $1.4
trillion? Okay, so it's a little, maybe it's a little more complicated than you just made it sound, but yeah, in a sense, yes, the federal government could say, look, we already hold 90% of all the outstanding student loan debt. It's held at the Department of Ed. So the government already owns those loans. So that's the easy part. The government just says to the people who are currently paying back those loans, you don't have to do that anymore. Okay, we're going to write it off. We're going to, in a sense, take the loss, right? We're not going to receive the principal and interest payments. You keep the money. don't pay it back. And then there's the rest of the outstanding student loan debt, which is privately held. And that's a little bit trickier. So you have to figure out how the government goes about dealing with that portion. Do you tell people don't pay back your loans and then private lenders get stiffed? That's not what we think makes sense. And so that's not what we do in the paper. We say the government could do one of two things. Either they acquire the loans and then tell borrowers that they no longer need to repay them, or they could simply take over the payments on behalf of the borrowers. And so most of what we did in the paper simulates the macroeconomic effects of the government canceling the bulk of the loans, those that are held already by the federal government, and then taking over the payments on the remaining privately held part of the debt.
We'll get into what the macroeconomic benefits that you see if that were to happen in just a second. But first, let's talk about why the federal government would consider doing this. Why is this a problem?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people on both sides of the political divide recognize that there is a problem with student loan debt, that millions of Americans are struggling to pay back loans that, so in many cases, people borrowed money and have been paying down. They thought they were paying down student loan debt because they've been paying on it. They've been servicing the loans for a number of years, and they owe more today than they did when they initially borrowed, right? And so it's a crazy problem for millions of Americans. Large numbers of people are in default. Millions more are in arrears. That is, they've fallen behind on their student loan payments. And so, there are people out there who are making their payments each month, some fairly comfortably. Others, it's tight for them that they are servicing their debt on time. But I think that, both Democrats and Republicans and lots of industry people, I mean, people in the housing industry understand that student loan debt is a problem because they're not seeing young people graduate from college, begin starting their lives, get married, buy a home. They're seeing the problem. So I think all across the economy, you have people who recognize that student loan debt is a drag on the overall economy.
So, but having the government to pick up the tab, $1.4 trillion in outstanding student loan debt, how would that overall benefit the national economy?
So what you got going on are basically two things. You say to people who currently, 44 million or so Americans, who are currently in some stage of paying back their loans, you know what, every month, instead of going to the drawer and grabbing your checkbook and sitting down and writing a $500 or $700 or $350 check to, service your student loan debt, don't do that anymore, okay? You don't have to do that. Now, the question is, what are they going to do with that money instead? So you have two things happening. One is an income effect. Disposable income goes up because you have hundreds of dollars available to you each month that you don't have to send to pay off your student loan debt. You can do something else with it. So as you might expect, people are going to turn around and spend that money in some other way. Now, they might also save a little bit. They might also pay down other types of debt, and that's all okay. But the vast majority of the impact is going to be disposable income goes up and people go out and spend more money into the economy. And that creates demand and that boosts output and employment. And so you have a stimulus effect there. The other effect comes not through the income side, but through the wealth effect. And here you're talking about, take these 44 million people, draw up their balance sheet, and, your net worth is the difference between what you own and what you owe. So the difference between your assets and your liabilities. And if you make this liability, if you make this debt go away, you're boosting the net worth of millions and millions of families. And so there's an income effect and there's a wealth effect. And you would expect positive stimulus to consumption spending. And then through that, because businesses have more customers, they see a pickup in demand, businesses then respond by doing what? By hiring more workers, by investing in more capital, because they're trying to meet the growing demand in the economy.
Who owns this debt? As we look at the demographics of who has student loan debt, that's a problem for them. This is something that the federal government is going to pick up the tab. That's all of us. I want to see that this is going to benefit all of us, at least up and down to the demographics that need the most help.
Yeah, it does. It benefits people up and down the demographics in terms of, let's say, the age demographics. And there aren't a whole lot of people who are 45 and older who have lots and lots of student loan debt. In part, that's because when they went to college was much more affordable. They didn't rely so heavily. States were investing more heavily, more federal government, more public money. And this was before we shifted more and more of the burden onto the student to borrow and pay for school. And so in terms of the demographics, canceling the student loan debt does help people and even seniors who are having some of their Social Security garnished in order to pay student loan debt. So you've got a huge problem here. But through the age demographics, mostly you're talking about people who are under 45 years of age. That's where the bulk of the student loan
sure,
debt
but,
is.
Sure, but are we talking about people who are minorities? Is this something that could be talked about as a way that could be sort of a way to break out of poverty? Because, these are the issues that nag the nation.
Yep, you're exactly right. So disproportionately, women struggle more than men do in terms of the amount of student loan debt that they take on average. Minorities, blacks and Hispanics, carry higher student loan debt on average as compared to Asians and whites. And so you're right, the debt tends to affect millennials more than generations that came before them. It affects blacks and other minority groups, ethnic and racial minority groups, more than it affects whites. It affects women more than it affects men.
And also they're making changes right now in Washington, D.C., to the student loan program that's actually going in the opposite direction in what
that's
you're
exactly
talking
right.
about. Yeah.
That's exactly right. To make it harder to allow private lenders to continue to collect and to have the bill collectors continue to ring the phone and knock on the door and assess deeper cuts, bigger penalties and fees and so forth. So that, like I said it before, you borrowed $10,000, but now you owe $68,000. How can that possibly be? Because the accumulation of the missed payment and penalties and interest accumulating, and so you're exactly right. Currently, we're going in the exact opposite direction.
Well, what about just the illogic of having a national system where we want our best and our brightest to reach their maximum potential and go to school and get these degrees mm-hmm. and become highly trained and become innovators and entrepreneurs and inventors but we penalize them and make it so difficult for them? That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, in countries that understand that education is a public good and that we don't just do this, we don't just encourage individuals to go out and get all the education that they can because it's good for them, because it's going to help them have a better career or something, that they're going to do exactly the kinds of things that you just said. They're going to be the innovators of the future. They're going to come up with the next cutting edge solutions to problems, that challenges that we face. And so they're making the kinds of investments. And there are countries where public colleges and universities are tuition free. The public does invest in the educational system because they foresee the benefits of the kind that you just described.
Stephanie Kelton is a professor of economics and public policy at Stony Brook University, and she's one of the authors of a report called The Macroeconomic Effects of Student Debt Cancellation.
Speaking for all the Pearl Wranglers and all the swell folks at the Pearl Brewing Company, brewers of premium quality Pearl beer, this is your old friend Adolf Hoffner saying goodbye, and thank you, good people.
That's Adolf Hoffner and his Pearl Wranglers. For decades, they were popular. A Texas country swing band based in San Antonio, sponsored by the local beer Pearl. The rise and decline of Pearl beer is a reflection of the rise and development and industrialization of Texas. It's a story told in a new book by beer historian Jeremy Banas, Pearl, A History of San Antonio's Iconic Beer.
Pearl had a profound effect, I think most anyone in San Antonio would agree, had a profound effect on the city's history, on its economy, on its people. It was, for the time it was brewing, 115 years of San Antonio's 300 years. And if you add in the modern day Pearl, that adds on to it even more. At one point in time around Prohibition, when that was getting ready to start, Pearl being the largest brewery and the other eight breweries accounted for three times more than any other industry as far as overall impact in monies paid out to employees. So it had a profound effect, not just with the people, but with the economy.
I guess we're talking about the time of Industrial Revolution, San Antonio. There was a hunger, a thirst for a great Pilsner beer.
Absolutely. And so Pearl actually came along, or San Antonio Brewing Association, about 30 years after brewing first began in San Antonio. So they weren't the first around and the first Germans to start. And anybody familiar with Germans in South Texas, wherever Germans landed, beer soon followed. So yeah, Pearl certainly filled a niche. They took over an existing brewery, City Brewery, that was brewing a Pilsner and a lager, and they came along, and as this brewery was going out of business, purchased it. And they wanted to do something different. They wanted to have that one quintessential beer that everybody'd go for. So 1886, City Brewery's in receivership and going out of business, and Otto Kaler, Otto Warmond, and a few other local San Antonio businessmen formed the San Antonio Brewing Association and buy City Brewery out of receivership. And they reincorporated as San Antonio Brewing Association and even operated in the same brewery, which was fairly high tech at that time. But they started building the now iconic Pearl Brew House that we see, that we've seen since 1894. So that was finished in 1894 along with the stables.
So this is right off the San Antonio River?
Correct.
Would that have been like an isolated part of the city, further away from the actual city?
There wasn't a whole lot out there. In fact, most of the homes that were around the brewery were homes for the employees.
How do people access Pearl beer?
Yeah, no, it was being delivered everywhere all over town. It became pretty popular very fast.
But you don't go out and buy a six-pack of Pearl.
No.
How do you access Pearl?
So they were getting it on draft.
So you have to go to the local saloon.
Correct.
And the saloons at the time were highly controlled.
Oh, they were very much controlled between the bar owners and the breweries. Before Prohibition, there were actually even several bars in town that were quote-unquote Pearl bars, a few that they owned outright and a few that served only their beer because of the contract they made.
So people may remember the days when Pearl beer was a highly recognized brand in the 50s, 60s, 70s here in Texas.
Yes. That had a whole lot to do with post-Prohibition, I would say. They had positioned themselves well enough during Prohibition, having to, incorporate a couple of slightly different business models, keeping people going. They were able to survive it. They come out of it. It's 1933. They start coming up with different ad campaigns to make beer again more popular. I mean, it was spirits became more popular after Prohibition than beer did. Beer took
rum and
big,
gin.
Absolutely. Bathtub gin.
San Antonio was a big rum town.
Yes, it was.
Coming up from the border.
Mm-hmm.
Pearl beer started promoting itself over the radio and became a very popular brand.
Oh, yes. No, absolutely. They became the brand in San Antonio, even more so than the original Lone Star that is now houses the San Antonio Museum of Art. That was opened by Adolphus Busch, and although there was a little bit of a rivalry back and forth with those guys, he chose not to try to persevere through Prohibition. Pearl did. Pearl comes out of Prohibition as the only brewery in San Antonio that survived, and one of only a couple in Texas. And so they had a little bit of an advantage as well.
So how does a beer company survive Prohibition? I mean, you just sell things that aren't beer?
Pretty much. Now, the government did allow breweries that were able to stay in business to produce near beer, so very, very low alcohol beer. Pearl also reincorporated themselves as Alamo Industries and Alamo Foods. So they had a whole dairy division, for example. They would make ice. They made sodas. They did anything they could to keep people employed. And that was Emma Kaler's plan was she convinced the board to keep things going, not to shut the brewery down, and keep people working during this time.
So you said she, so that's Emma.
That's correct.
Emma Kaler.
Yes.
Let's get into the Emmas.
Okay.
Tell me who the Emmas are.
All right, so let's start off with Emma Kaler, that Otto Kaler's wife. So Otto Kaler being probably the more known of the original founders. In little before 1914, one of her trips with Otto Kaler to Germany, she allegedly got into a car accident. And that's very debatable in the historical record, but suddenly became bedridden. They come back to the United States, and she has a nurse with her whose name is Emma Burgermeister. And Emma Burgermeister moves into the house with the Kalers and is taking care of bedridden Emma. So he's having an affair with the nurse, the Emma nurse who came back with them from Germany. She has a friend who's a nurse named Emma as well. She comes to work for the Kalers. He ends up having an affair with both. In fact, he bought a house just for them and put it in their name off of Hunstock Street in you know, south of downtown, and he would go visit with them there. And the way it happened was one of the Emmas was getting married, and he didn't want her to get married, but he decided to try to hold tighter to Emma Burgermeister, the one that was not the nurse who wasn't getting married. He wants to solidify things with Emma Burgermeister, who's not getting married. Regardless of what version of how he, why he got shot by one of the Emmas. That Emma runs off to Europe to be a nurse in the war and comes back, gets indicted by a grand jury, but is later found innocent. And she was looked upon as being very beautiful and charming. And there was a lot of evidence against her for having premeditated this. But at any rate, he passes away, and Emma Kaler, by default, becomes the de facto president. There was an official president, Otto Warmond. He was one of the original founders. But it was Emma Kaler as the majority owner that was doing a whole lot of the running things at that time.
This became an international scandal of the three Emmas and Otto Kaler. What did that do to the brand, of the Pearl brand?
Not a thing. There is no evidence that sales dipped or people thought any less of the company or any or the beer itself. In fact, it still became exceedingly popular. It outsold Lone Star.
What's the story to be taken away from the rise and fall of Pearl beer, especially being held up as a mirror to beer consumption in Texas?
So I think a lot of Pearl's decline, taking nothing away from what Southdown tried to do and what Pabst tried to do before they shut it down and are still trying to do with Pearl. But I think corporate ownership was Pearl's downfall. Up until 1969 or 1970, it was under the same family ownership it had been under since 1886, basically. And so regardless of how large Pearl got, it was the same family ownership. It was a family touch. Everybody that ever worked there that I spoke to, they consider themselves family. And that has a whole lot to do, I think, with the success of not just breweries, but a lot of industries in general. So corporate ownership coming into it, I think, sort of eventually killed it like it did the second generation of Lone Star. What we're seeing now with a lot of the microbreweries is we're seeing mostly independent ownership with them. Things may be being done on a little bit smaller scale or a larger scale, similar to Pearl's impact at one point. But we're seeing individual independent ownership, and that trickles down to the employees and trickles down to the quality.
And it gives you good beer.
Yeah, it gives you very good beer.
Jeremy Banas is a beer historian, the author of Pearl, A History of San Antonio's Iconic Beer. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org, and you can comment on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us wherever you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.